Okay. Yeah. As one of the conveners mentioned, I forgot your name, sorry.
Mark.
Mark. As Mark mentioned, I'm Rhys Whittlely. I'm going to talk a bit about the Portable.net Interpreter. I did actually give a talk at last year's ELF before the microphone cut out about Portable.net in overall and all the bits and pieces, including the C# compiler and whatnot. I'm going to talk a little bit about the overall picture today and give a one-year update on how far we've come since then. But mostly I'm going to talk about the design of the interpreter itself and how we played some little tricks to actually make it run fast, despite what you may have heard is that interpreters are supposed to be slow. So I'll just jump into it. Oh, first things first. In this lecture, we're not going to mention the M word. And I am a toolchain hacker. And a special thank you to B. Dale, who doesn't appear to be here, because I used testdrive.hp.com last night and found myself a 32 versus 64-bit bug. And so IA64 is kind of sort of working now, but Alpha is a bit busted at the moment. But so thanks to HP for putting up that stuff. Anyway, so in this talk, I'm going to talk about what is Portable.net, so like what design constraints did I place on myself when I did it, and then so start talking about some of the details of how I actually went about to implement it. First of all, talking about Microsoft's polymorphic instruction set, which is one of the most annoying features of it and one of the most interesting features of it. And then talk about how, through converting it from one format into another, I actually made the process easier. And I'm currently at step 3. Haven't yet got to step 4 on that particular bullet. And talk about speed and issues and why I hate GCC, and end with the obligatory table of made-up numbers. Yeah. So Portable.net started in January of 2001 with the initial goal of trying to implement what Microsoft calls the common language infrastructure, which is the underlying virtual machine, C# compiler and whatnot that underlies their so-called .NET thing. And .NET is a very overused term by Microsoft. It's not really very clear exactly what it is from one week to the next with them. I've chosen to say that what it means to me is basically the bits and pieces that support the C# language and other languages that can run on top of the common language runtime. But even though it started off just focusing on C# and stuff, we're actually starting to look into other ways of extending this to other bits and pieces, and this was only just beginning last year at LCA, and now it's really getting going. We currently can compile a subset of ANSI C down to IL bytecode and actually run it on top of our engine, and you can take the same binary and run it on multiple different platforms with whether 64, 32-bit, whatever they are, that's the theory at least. When I say a subset, that doesn't mean that I'm actually taking things out of language, it means I just haven't implemented the rest yet. And there's someone about to start to figure out how we can actually compile Java down to IL, and we're also looking at how to compile C# down to JVM, and we're working with the Parrot guys. Who's familiar with Parrot? A few people. That's the new runtime engine that underlies Perl 6. It's a very weird thing based on, it uses a register machine rather than a stack machine, which I personally don't think was a good idea, but hey, they didn't ask me. But so we're actually working with them to actually compile C# down to Parrot, because they did actually have it, they actually did start to try to make a kind of a C# subset. And we said, hey, we already got a C# compiler, we'll make it work for you, and in the process help you figure out what kind of object support you need in your engine to support Perl and other languages. Portable.net doesn't exist in isolation. It's part of this greater .gnu project under the Free Software Foundation, and there's also people looking into web services and authentication to try to provide a complete, broad solution to the whole .NET thing. And unlike a year ago, where it was me, myself, I, and Rhys working on this, there's now me, myself, I, and Rhys, and Goppel, and Peter, and a few other bits and pieces, people out there. So we're actually starting to build up the community now, which wasn't there a year ago. And so we're actually starting to make some good progress and starting to branch out into other areas, like that little Mahjong game some of you might have saw. That was built on top of QT Sharp, which was done by a bunch of other guys who are now working with us to actually build better GUI environments that we can use with our stuff. So not only is the community building in the project, but it's also we're branching out and sort of working with other groups as well. Anyway, the most important design constraint that I put on myself when I started this is it must be portable first. That while it may be interesting to be able to put in kinds of lots of x86 hacks, we should always build the portable version first, because that allows you to get up, an interpreter always allows you to get up and going quickly on a new platform. And we have quite literally been able to get going on new platforms in under 24 hours. Mac OS 10 port took me about 6 hours of Telnet into some poor person's machine, actually trying to make the thing work. And so from day one, it's always abstract the operating system differences and whatnot, and let's make sure that it's always going to be portable. And central to this is always the idea that I believe Jeffrey kind of talked about earlier in his Katy talk, is kind of make it work and then make it work better. I actually put this on here before I heard your talk, so kind of in parallel, so I didn't copy it in afterwards. But this is a very important thing for open source projects, I think, is to get something working. Then you can get the community in to help you play around and make it work better. But if you try too hard to make the perfect thing to start off with, you're just not going to get going. And just because Microsoft does certain things doesn't mean we necessarily do. We do stick to the ECMA specifications for C# as much as is actually possible in a Unix environment, but we otherwise just ignore whatever crap they've come up with. The distinguishing characteristic of IL compared to the JVM is that instead of having one instruction for each type, like the JVM has integer add, long add, float, double, etc., IL only has one bytecode instruction, add, and similarly for subtract and multiply, divide, etc. And this is kind of annoying, because when you come to write an interpreter, you're constantly having to do this thing where you switch on bytecode, you come in on add, and the first thing you have to do is check the types of the values on the stack and say, is it an integer? Okay, do this. Is it a long? Do that. Is it something else? Do some other thing. And it just really, really slows things down. And this was a real pain in the neck to try to get around with initially. I did initially try to write a polymorphic interpreter, which the the M Mono guys also did. And it's just really, really slow. And while portable is good, performance is also good. Now, I actually believe that Microsoft made a mistake with this. I think what really happened was they ran out of opcodes. And so they said, what are we going to do? And so then they started combining opcodes. And then they still ran out of opcodes. And then they introduced prefixes. And they probably should have just had prefixed opcodes from day one. But in the way that these things go is someone implements a bug, and then they find a good reason for using it. And so Microsoft has now got this generic IL that actually relies upon this bug called polymorphism. Which we're not doing generic IL yet, but probably later this year we'll start looking at it, because the specifications are still up in the air at the moment. So the process, please stop me if I'm boring anyone. The process kind of goes like this, that within the interpreter core, every time a method is called, first of all checks to see if there's a cache CVM version. And CVM stands for the converted virtual machine. That instead of trying to interpret IL directly, we first of all convert it into a completely different bytecode, which is a lot less dense. And it actually has instructions like IADD and LADD and so forth, which actually do the individual pieces. And if we have to use prefixes, we use prefixes to get enough bytecodes. Excuse me. And so the process checks to see if there's one there already from the previous run. If not, it calls the bytecode verify, which chomps through the code and so it says, okay, well, what's going on here? Oh, it's an integer add, it's an add instruction. Okay, what do we got on the stack? We've got two integers on the stack. Great, okay. Then it calls this thing called the coder, which then takes that information and say, this is an add of two integers, and then spits out CVM code. Now, from the diagram, I'm not sure if you can all read it there, but from the diagram, the coder system was designed to be pluggable. So it's not just CVM that could do this, but also could do the JIT coding as well. So one of the things we're going to be working on this year is looking into real JITs. But as I said before, make it work, make it portable before making it better. But the system is very easily pluggable. And one of the good things about this is when you're writing a JIT, you don't have to worry about building all the rest of the stuff as well. It's already there. So it's very, very isolated in the code. And then it goes through and then jumps into the interpreter. Any questions so far? Because they basically ran out. Java has int, long, float, double. C# has int, unsigned int, long, unsigned long, etc., etc. So it has more types. And so when you do all the combinations and permutations of instructions with types, you kind of get more than 256. So it didn't fit in a byte anymore. And it's just, well, what do we do? What do we do? Now, what they should have done was start to do some analysis and say, okay, what's the most common instructions? And we'll give them a 1-byte code. And then what's the least common instructions? Give them a 2-byte code, which is what they eventually did end up doing, because they still ran, after they did the polymorphism, they still ran out. But then they found a use for it with generic IL, where you could actually have one class, you can have a bytecode version of class, which is actually, instead of being instantiated at compile time the way that C++ rather does, you could actually have a runtime instantiation where you can come along and say, okay, I've got this matrix class and I want to have matrix of int or matrix of float or whatever. And so you can actually internally have the add instruction being used, and it'll just expand out to the right set of instructions. So there is some use for it, but I think they actually discovered the generic thing after they'd actually made the design mistake, which that happens a lot. There's a few of those in Java as well. One of the big benefits of this approach, like initially I thought that IL being polymorphic was a bug, but it actually forced me to innovate and actually sort of come up with a cleverer, not necessarily the best, but a cleverer solution than just direct polymorphic interpretation. And I found that in the process of doing that, there are some things that you can do when you convert it into a completely different format that you can't do, or is very difficult to do if you stay within the original format. Like, you can recognize common operations. You see a call to the string concatenation method, and you go, well, we don't want to have a method call overhead every time we do string concatenation, because that's happening all the time, so why don't we make a special opcode for that? And so the CVM instruction set actually has a string concat, which can be done inline within the engine itself and removes a huge amount of overhead. This is very easy to do, and it's kind of what JITs do. JITs do this same kind of thing, is they remove the overhead by saying, oh, well, I can inline that. And so you get some benefits, so that even though it's still an interpreter and it's still sort of portable C code, you actually get some of the benefits of a JIT by actually making a conscious decision to have a different bytecode format outside the engine compared with inside the engine. And the CVM system is designed specifically not to be serialized. It never gets written out the disk. It never gets loaded in back in the way a Java class file or something would. It's explicitly designed to be inside. If it was serialized, you'd actually lose many of the benefits. You know, like being able to adapt to the particulars of the CPU. Different CPUs have different byte orders. And sometimes when you're, say, taking the address of a local variable, if the local variable is a byte or a short, well, you need to take addresses of different indexes into the word on the stack to be able to do that. And depending on whether it's big endian or little endian, you might have to do different things. And sometimes you can optimize these away, because he says, oh, on a little endian CPU, the address of the byte is going to be the same as the address of the word, so we'll just optimize that away. But if you serialized it, you'd have to always put that instruction there, because you wouldn't necessarily know who's going to load it next. And so, like, also problems come up with sizes of values and whatnot. Another big benefit that you get is there's actually this very powerful technique. There's a couple of powerful techniques for high-speed interpretation called token threading and direct threading. Token threading is like your traditional switch loop. You come in, you do a switch and say, oh, this is an add instruction, or it's a subtract, or it's a negate, or it's a whatever. Token threading speeds that up a little bit using computed go-tos in GCC. I can show you them later if that doesn't necessarily make much sense. Direct threading says that instead of storing the bytecodes in the instruction stream, we'll store pointers to handlers in the instruction stream. So instead of saying, okay, fetch the byte, look up a table, find the address of the handler, jump to that, you just store the address of the handler directly in the instruction stream itself, and you just fetch it out and jump to it. This doesn't necessarily give you much more improvement in performance on x86 and CISC-style CPUs, but on a RISC CPU like a Spark or an ARM, direct threading actually gives you a huge improvement in performance, because looking up values in a table on a RISC CPU is actually very expensive. And this is another thing that's very difficult to do if you serialize things out on the wire, is because how do you change the instruction representation? How do you even do the pointers? Because you write the thing out, and you load it back in, the pointers are all different because things have been relocated in memory and stuff. So by using the conversion and taking the explicit, making the explicit choice to say, let's have something completely different on the inside and the outside of the engine, we can actually get many of the benefits of a JIT. We can actually use different interpretation styles and techniques internally without actually losing our portability in the process. And I get to use lots and lots of macros. So, because when you're switching between these different interpretation techniques, you really need to use macros, because you've got, like in the traditional switch, you've got a break at the end of the case. Well, I replace that with a computed go-to in certain cases. If I didn't use macros, my system would fall apart. GCC sucks for virtual machines. Really, really sucks. GCC is optimized for compiling ordinary applications and kernels and other things like that that no one cares about. Not the real men. Not us people who get the chicks, apparently. Anyway, part of the problem is that in a regular application where you've got something like a switch statement, you're normally going to have a small number of cases, maybe 10 or 20, that are each doing very, very different things. But the kind of things that are being done in every case is very, very different. But in a virtual machine, things are very much the same. An add instruction, a subtract, and a multiply and divide, the code for these are very, very similar. And unfortunately, GCC tries to extract things out in a way that doesn't really help the situation. And I'll kind of try to explain this by sort of pointing at the code here. This is kind of a simplified version of some of the code from my interpreter for the integer add and the integer subtract instruction on the left here. And as you can see, the two cases are pretty much the same, just with the difference of the operator here. When GCC translates this into assembly code, you kind of end up with something that looks like what's on the right, where it says, okay, add, do the add operation, and then go to tail. What the heck's that? And then in there, subtract. It does the subtract operation and falls through to tail. What's happening here is GCC is saying, oh, these two blocks on the left here, they end in the same code. So I'm going to be a great little compiler, and I'm going to combine those. I'm going to save you some space. And I'm going to put them in a common place and make everyone else jump to it. This is really, really bad in an interpreter, because the CPU itself uses pipelining techniques to try to speed up execution. If you have flat, straight code that just falls through from one instruction to the next, to the next, to the next, it actually runs very fast. It can actually sort of pipeline and do instruction scheduling and all kinds of clever things. But if you've got code like this that kind of jumps all over the place, it just completely stuffs up branch prediction, it stuffs up the pipeline, this thing's going flushing all the time, and performance just sucks. The annoying thing is that in GCC 2.95 in some modes, and in GCC 3.2 in all modes apparently, you can't turn it off. You can't stop it doing this, which is very annoying. Are there any GCC hackers here? Lucky, because I beat you up. The really annoying thing is that it's just not possible to turn this off. Unless you turn off all optimizations, in which case the result is really, really looks like crap. It's really annoying. I actually looked into the GCC 2.95 sources at one stage about a year and a half ago and traced it all down. And the particular optimization that does this tail end combination is the one that doesn't have a flag on it. Every other optimization in the engine seems to have a flag except one. The funny thing was that when I changed to using computed go-tos instead of breaks to actually do the sort of look up in the table and jump, it actually worked. We got straight line code back again, and I'm thinking, what's going on here? Because if you just put go-to table lookup at the end of these, the code at the end is still the same, and you think, oh, GCC is just going to combine it and stuff it up again. It actually turns out that it worked, and I'm going, what goes on? So I jumped back in the code, had a look around, and they got a hack in there, a great big hack in the middle of GCC. If it ends in a computed go-to, then do it properly. Leave the code straight line. Except that they broke it in 3.2. If you go to the GCC website right now and you do a search for computed go-to, then half the responses that come back will be VM people whinging and moaning that all the optimizations have been broken. And another thing that's annoying, if any of you are compiler people, is the register keyword. In modern compilers, the compiler writers essentially just ignore the register keyword. Now, while this is all well and fine on ordinary application code, when usually the compiler actually does know better than the programmer which things are going to be most used in the code, in a virtual machine, the compiler is always wrong. It always chooses the wrong thing to say, oh, let's put this in a register. So it'd be really nice if GCC had a way so you could say, make the register keyword do what I say it does because I know what needs to be in registers. Because you really want the program counter, the stack pointer, the frame pointer in registers. If they're not in registers, the result's going to be a mess. So all these brilliant ideas that the compiler guys have come up with over the years don't really work for this kind of class of application. Now, I did manage to munge it in GCC 295. You can do some tricks with it, but fix the blinking compiler guys. Right. So you can combine a number of techniques here to actually make the thing run faster and faster. There's your simple switch statements, of course, which aren't very fast. Now, having said that register keyword doesn't work, in some versions of GCC, you can actually sort of make it work. You can say, I want this variable in the ESI register on IA386. Now, that sort of works, except that it's not portable anymore. Now we've got the problem that it doesn't really work on all platforms, and not all versions of GCC have this little register naming hack. And so, really, they need to fix the compiler to make the register keyword work again. And I already talked a little bit about token threading, direct threading, and the difference there. That's essentially where you change from a switch statement to using a computer go-to. And does anyone know? Does anyone want to know what a computer go-to looks like? Okay, sorry. Let me show you a simple switch case first. Okay, so this is the simple switch case, which we sort of saw before. The go-to one looks more like this. Let's see if we can get it all in there. So you got a table that, instead of the switch, you've got a table of labels, which you can kind of build using some macro tricks, so it's usually not so bad as doing this. Excuse me. And so the code to actually perform the operation is still pretty much the same, except that instead of the break at the end, you've now got this go-to look up the label table for the thing in the program counter, which is the bytecode, and then jump to whatever address you get out of the label table. And direct threading is a slight modification of that, where it looks more like this. Oops. Where you actually, sort of, instead of fetching the address of the handler out of the table, you fetch it directly out of the instruction stream. So when the CVM coder writes out the CVM code, it actually writes out the address of the handler, which it pulls out of the table itself, rather than actually putting in the bytecode. Does that help? Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of interesting bugs. Let me see. Yeah. So it's the same code each time. And you can finesse it with macros. Like in the actual, this is just a fabricated example, but in the actual portable.net code itself, which I didn't prepare earlier. So hopefully this won't fuck up. Oh, sorry. Set what? Sorry. I didn't know that. I'll have to write that down. But this is the same kind of thing. This is actually in the engine. The one I showed you before was a simplified version. And there's lots of macros like this VM case. If you compile it in switch mode, then it becomes just a case label. If you compile it in token or direct threading, it becomes a normal label and whatnot. And so the VM break expands out to either a real break or a go-to or whatnot. So this is why I like macros, is you can actually make the code look relatively declarative and actually say what you really mean without having too many hash ifs and stuff going on all the time. So if any of you are language design people, well, next time you design a language, make sure you put the preprocessor in, because it's one of the most useful things. I hate these languages that take out the preprocessor. It's just yuck. Sorry? But because the language is, because the language like that doesn't actually support preprocessing natively, it's more of a hack. So I'd like to actually see people think more cleverly about doing real preprocessors. And the last one is not really an interpreter, but it's something that I threw together in about a week a while ago, a technique called unrolling. And this is where we've converted from IL into CVM. For some CVM instructions, I then converted into x86 machine code, and this is where I throw away my must be portable at all costs thing. What you kind of get is some of the benefits of a JIT without the difficulty of actually writing a JIT. Because what's difficult about writing a JIT is like setting up all the code and it's like building the trees and doing the optimization and the register allocation, all that kind of stuff, and it's a big pain in the neck. Unrolling is a simple technique how you can get some additional speed for an interpreter, get some of the benefits of the speed of a real JIT without actually having to write yourself a real JIT. And so it literally took me about a week to just write this, and I got something like a 4 or 5-fold improvement in performance from doing it. So finally, before I go for questions, made up numbers. These aren't completely made up. This is done with GCC 295, I might say, because 3.2, some of these columns are really shitty because they broke the optimization. The different benchmarks here, sieve, loop, logic, etc., are basically the caffeine mark, same as the caffeine mark benchmarks. I just ported the caffeine mark across to C#, line by line, every bug intact, and then just ran it. And so we got the different kinds. We've just got a plain simple switch loop, one that actually uses some manual register assignment, but only for x86, token threading, direct threading. And as I said before, the difference between token and direct threading of using either a look up the table or just fetch the address directly isn't very great. It's like doesn't really differ all that much. Bigger is better. Bigger and better here. Sorry. The comparison, the baseline comparison is basically this is Mono's JIT running on the same machine. And it's basically, it's like, okay, 100% of JIT performance. Tokens give you 18% of JIT performance. On these examples, you make up other benchmarks, you'll get different answers, of course. The interesting thing about running benchmarks, which is why it's a form of lies, is you can always make a benchmark that makes the other guy's engine look terrible. Right, so, whoops. Yeah, so it actually, so the unrolled version actually does very well. It actually, so like, even though it's not a full-blown JIT and the algorithms that it's using aren't terribly great, it actually gets to 70% of a real JIT on these kinds of things. And most of these are compute-bound tests. Most of these are compute-bound tests rather than actually memory-bound. The string test is a memory-bound test, so it doesn't necessarily do as well. And this is Mono's interpreter, which is just a direct polymorphic interpreter. And Miguel will probably kill me for showing you these numbers, but anyway. Anyone confused? Okay, we currently have C#, which is about 95-99% of ECMA compatible at the moment. We've got a C compiler. People starting to look into Java and stuff like that. And we're also working with other teams. There's a group in the University of Melbourne that build a language called Mercury, which is some new age version of Prolog, very strange language. And they actually work with Microsoft to port their stuff to .NET, and I'm going to be working with them soon. It's like on the side, so Microsoft doesn't know. But I'm going to be working with them to actually make their stuff work. And I'm also working on things like JScript, which is kind of Microsoft's version of JavaScript. So we are working on different languages, and it is working quite fine. So we already have multiple languages working. We don't use GCC for this. It doesn't generate Stack Machine code terribly well, so it is my own compiler. It is kind of organized as front-end, back-end. You can actually plug in new languages into the back of it quite easily if you want to. Just mean write a binary and stick it in the right directory. This is kind of a philosophical thing, and it's like, it's people who have built register compilers in the past like register machines, and people who have built stack compilers in the past like stack machines. It's kind of six and one half dozen the other, actually. If you're writing a JIT, it doesn't matter whether it's a stack machine or a register machine, because by the time the JIT's done with the code, all notions of sort of like placement are just done away with. If you're writing an interpreter, stack machines do have a slight advantage in that the code for each instruction is a lot simpler, and so you can chomp through them faster. I think that Parrot was made a mistake because they pretty much committed themselves to building JITs, because the interpreter will never really be all that fast. And writing JITs for different platforms, especially on all the millions of platforms Perl needs to run on, is difficult. It's kind of a religious war type thing. There's the stack people and the register people, and I'm a stack person. Anything else? As far as I'm aware, there shouldn't be any, barring bugs, there shouldn't be any endianness issues for a language like C#. Like if you compile a C# application or even a Java application, you shouldn't have any endianness issues running the bytecode. For C, things are different, because there's always the odd stupid programmer who puts endian dependencies in his code and without actually realizing it. Things like taking the address of an int and taking the address of a char and assuming that it's aligned with ints and weird things like that. You can get pretty close as long as you say to the programmer, look, all bets are off if you don't know what ANSI-C is. But you can get pretty close. Certainly with languages other than C, it's very easy because the language itself makes it very difficult to get your hands on the endian sort of particulars. And so because that's isolated, it's not too bad. Because IL depends upon front-end translation a lot more to get performance, I don't think you'd ever see an IL chip. I don't think it'd be a good idea to have even a Java chip. So, but one of the ways in which the Java chips apparently get performance is actually by doing translation internally, that they actually do translate so internally to another, like another CPU format anyway. So it is possible, but the overhead of doing that for JVM is a lot less than doing it for IL. There's a lot more work. Like with JVM, you can almost do a one-to-one transformation on it. With IL, you've got to do some more in-depth analysis to track the values on the stack to say, oh, okay, well, it's going to be integers. Whereas JVM actually tells you, once you've run the verifier, it's okay. In a virtual machine, you've got a large number of things that are all sort of the same, but just slightly different. But in regular applications, when you have, say, something like a switch statement, the cases are normally doing different things a lot more, and or there's a lot fewer of them. Like if you've only got 20 cases in the switch, then and some of them share some code, then it may be a good idea to do this tail-end combination. But in the case of a virtual machine, you've got 200, 300, 400 cases sometimes, depending on how you lay it out. I think I've got about 300 instructions in CVM now with prefixes. Then you get a lot of common code, and so it spends most of its time jumping to common code. Because pretty much every instruction ends with increment the program counter and adjust the stack pointer. And so that causes the code to end up with two instructions jump, two instructions jump, two instructions jump, and that may be okay in a switch statement that's only got a few cases and only used once a day, but not when you're doing it for every single loop around the system. You go first. I haven't personally looked at the Python virtual machine, so I don't really know. Yeah, I'm sure they've got a whole bunch of hacks in there too and probably hate the GCC guys at the moment. C-sharp applications work pretty well, as long as the libraries are there. Like, there's the orthogonal issue of the C-sharp class library that, like, if the Microsoft.NET program calls some library that we don't have, well, we're just going to have to sit down and write that or nick it from somewhere or something. We are working with the Mono guys a little bit to share code at the higher level libraries. Like, we don't care about Windows.forms. We're going to let them bang their head against that one. But Visual C++ .NET applications will probably never run on portable .NET or Mono, because the way Microsoft compiles those binaries is they make a lot of callouts to native Windows DLLs and have lots of NDN dependencies and whatnot. I think that the way it happened is the .NET guys gave the Visual C++ guys the specs for the engine, and they basically wrote their compiler around the things they could understand and then just dropped down to native code for what they couldn't understand. And so there's a lot of that going on in there. My C compiler, on the other hand, always compiles to pure IL, makes no native callouts whatsoever. Even the libc that I use that implements printf and strcpy and all the rest of it, even that is compiled down to IL bytecode and then runs on top of the normal runtime engine. So I made a policy of no native code. So it's probably going to be impossible that Visual C++ apps are ever going to run Visual Basic apps. Mono's looking into some of the library support. I don't know how well it's going to work. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's the big thing. That's the big thing that we're going to have to do in this next year is get the libraries built out.
Yeah, because I mean, for example, the guys doing video applications have had quite an amount of success with not an awful amount of code getting Windows DLLs to actually do the dumb thing on the lens. I wonder whether you'd examine that sort of thing.
Definitely. I haven't really done much like that myself. I don't want to pull across a Windows DLL and say, okay, now the thing works.
Yeah, I understand the philosophical objections to doing it.
Yeah, because I kind of normally sort of work for RMS a little bit, and this is part of the GNU project, and so I can't do that. But the Mono guys were Windows Forms, which is their GUI library, which is Microsoft's GUI library. They're actually wrapping that around the Wine libraries to actually get the Windows functionality. So once they actually get that going, there might be some possibility of actually getting some of this Windows-like functionality through Wine, but I'll let them do the experiment and blow up before I try and do it.
I mean, where I was really heading on the question is things like, you know, a JDBC equivalent, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. The Mono guys do have system.data, which is the ADO.NET stuff. I'm concentrating mostly on the lower level things and things that can support the Docker new infrastructure. Some of the more high level stuff like ASP.NET and whatnot, I personally couldn't care too much about that. If someone wants to contribute patches, that's great, but we're mostly letting the Mono guys hang themselves on that. Because the more time they spend doing that, the less time they're doing all this basic stuff, and so I win that game. Anyway, anything more? Thank you.